Succession number 27058, reel 12.
Now, in those days, the evening meal in Australia was known as tea. Your three meals were breakfast, lunch and tea. But Mum used the word dinner. And my mum happened to be a fantastic cook. So I couldn't ring Patty and ask her if she was on the high seas somewhere. So I knew that the last port for her ship was Colombo. So I wrote to Colombo, sent the letter to Colombo, and I said, you won't be able to answer this, but my mum has asked you to come home for dinner that night. It suits me because to go up to Perth would be a risk if so-and-so happens, and I wouldn't want you to take you anywhere in Fremantle because I don't think there's anywhere that's very nice.
Bit rough as guts.
Yep. So I said, I'll pick you up when the ship gets to Fremantle and we'll go home and have a meal with Mum. And I hope this suits you. Of course, I didn't get a reply. And I went down. Frank had a very nice, beautiful Dodge car, and he said, well, you take the Dodge and bring Patty here for dinner. So I drove down to Fremantle, found out where the ship was going to berth, met Patty, and she'd obviously done something with her uniform, which looked very smart, and she had her hair done, which looked very, very nice, and she was wearing a decent pair of silk stockings. The issue for New Zealand was what they call Lyle stockings, awful bloody stuff. It looks like everything's got varicose veins all over them. And she looks absolutely delightful. So I said, what about tea with my mum? Patty said, can't wait, let's go. So I drove up to Shenton Park, where we lived at the time, went indoors. We used the front door, otherwise we used to go around the back. And I'll never forget this. As soon as Mum saw Pat, I thought her face was going to fall off. I've never seen her smile so much in all her life. And another thing I noticed with some amusement, my stepfather was a very, very casual chap. And the first thing he did when he got home from the office, take his jacket and tie off, undo his shirt and roll his sleeves up. And we had all our meals, as most people did, I think, in those days in the kitchen. But tonight we used the dining room. And we saw crockery I'd never seen in my life before. And Frank was sitting in a chair with his collar undone, and as soon as he saw Patty, he jumped out of the steering rather than he'd been electrocuted, shot into the bedroom and came back in a few minutes with a collar and tie and a jacket on. And my mum was a fantastic cook. I didn't realise how good she was until I had to eat food prepared by somebody else other than my mum, which gave me a bit of a shock initially. And I can't remember whether it was spring or winter. I think it was winterish, I think. I can't even remember the month now. But anyway, we all went and sat down at this nicely laid out table. Oh, and we had a little fox terrier pup called Nip. He was a beautiful little dog, and Patty made a fuss of Nip, and he thought that she was someone else to play with. No, marvellous time. But Mum made a beautiful meal, something like a minestrone. And of course, Pat had spent 6 weeks on a troop ship, and the food on troop ships is notoriously appalling, and that's on the good days. And Mum made this beautiful soup, which she served in a huge bowl, and Patty went through that like you wouldn't believe. Mum said, like some more soup? Oh, yes, please. So Mum trotted off, and my mum liked to see people eat, and came another bowl of soup. And Mum had cooked something with my favourite, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. And my mum didn't serve roast beef in slices, she served it in slabs. And there was about a pound and a half of Yorkshire pudding for everybody. And if you left so much as a gravy stain, you got a look of distinguished disapproval, which meant you wouldn't have any visiting rights for the next 50 years. And that was followed, Pat had two of everything, and that was followed by a huge bowl of wine trifle. And Mum started to look at a watch. And she said, don't forget Patty back on time because the ship's sailing at 11 o'clock. I'll do that. So we finished a very nice meal and drove off, drove down to Fremantle. And Patty said, you're right to eat. I said, yep. And she said, well, how can you? She said, well, I'll be. And I was going to ask you that. So she handed me a slip of paper and said, that's my address. So she gave me that and off she went. I didn't see her for years.
But you kept in touch, obviously, and as I understand, you caught up not so long ago.
Well, a few years ago, I suddenly realised I was living here. I suddenly realised that to get to New Zealand, all you've got to do is to buy a ticket and get on an aeroplane. And I could do that by myself without any trouble at all. So I wrote to Pat and said, I'm coming over for a holiday. Stand by. And I said, well, you know, it's years since we've seen each other. I suppose it's possible we might not get along as well as we used to. That'd be a bit of a tragedy, wouldn't it? You can give me the answer when I see you. So she wrote back and said, well, I'll book you into a little motel not too far from where I am. And I'm looking forward to seeing you. So over I went and spent about 2 months in Auckland. And Paddy had a very nice home on a promontory of land which stretched out into the sea a bit in South Auckland. And if you stand in Paddy's kitchen, the view was about 270 degrees all sea with a few little islands. And we had a very nice 2 months, very nice. Paddy's very fond of bushwalking. And I do that a bit myself. And she had a very nice little motor car. So we went out every day. We just went on a little picnic and we'd take loaves of bread and go for a walk through the woodlands and feed birds and so on and so. And that's where it all began. And
what was it like after all those years to see each other again?
She hadn't changed a bit. Not a bit. Not a whisker. And in fact...
How many years had it been?
25. She booked me to this very nice motel, very nice indeed, because I didn't get there until about 10:30 at night. Because that was the timetable of the aeroplane. And she booked the room for me, and when we got there, she took me into the room, and she made me some coffee, and she produced a cardboard box about that big, filled with chicken and salad sandwiches. So we were still sitting there, eating chicken and sandwich until about 12:30. And she said, I'd better go home and get some sleep, and I'll see you in the morning. So she called for me every morning about 9-ish, and we'd go this way, that way, all over the place, and which we enjoyed. And not long after that, Patty wrote to me and said, I'm going to come and visit you. It'll work with you, and I hope it served me. So she told me her flight number, and she came over when my young son got married. And I found a little flat just around the corner from here. And I think she stayed 2 months, and we went bushwalking along here. She liked going to Yanchep because there's a very nice old-fashioned pub in Yanchep which used to serve a very nice cantaloupe, and that's what we did. But Paddy loved fish. I think Paddy would eat fish every day of her life, and nearly every day, not always but more than often, we finished up at Fremantle at Kayla's Brothers or Cicerello's, down right on the waterfront, sitting under a huge colourful umbrella, buying just ordinary what they call fish and chips and a little plastic box of salad. And Paddy would sit there for hours and hours and hours just woofing fish and chips in her fingers. And
how did the relationships formed during wartime differ from those that you made in peacetime?
Well, of course, when I made relationships, I don't think I had a relationship before the war. I got very friendly with a couple of young ladies, but I don't think there was nothing of a serious vein at all. We were just what you'd call friends. Because, unfortunately, I never had much of a chance of getting a good job because of my lack of education. That was the thing that worried me when the war finished, because I knew that I'd be demobbed, and I knew that my income would stop. And once again, I had no skills that would interest any employer.
Presumably, from what you've told me, you made female relationships in after the war.
Yep.
How did they differ from, say, the caring and loving feelings that you had for Renee and Paddy?
They were different. I'm not sure how they were different, but the built-in affection that I had both for Irini and Patty, I don't think I could ever have again for anybody else, ever. They had a great deal of meaning. When I got back to the squadron after leave, I looked forward and I lived for the next leave to scoot back to Alex as fast as possible.
And I was wondering to what degree the war made those feelings stronger?
Well, depending on your luck, they could have been fairly short term. So I always found that if I went on leave with young Irene, it was always in the back of my mind that I may not have another leave. And that seemed to make that particular leave I was enjoying then more pertinent and very, very, very important. I never discussed it with Irene, of course, but I probably think she felt the same because she insisted I take this crucifix she gave me. But, as I say, once the leave was over and you go back to the squadron, life suddenly becomes real and very bloody earnest.
I'm interested in that whole scenario, and my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that those relationships are burnt into your sort of psyche more powerfully because each time you see those people...
Could be the last. That's very true indeed. Same with when I met Patty. Because the squadron I went to was a volunteer squadron. The losses were so high because of the nature of the operations, which in those days unusual, and they were bloody hazardous, let's face it. You had to do everything right if you're firing a rocket, because if you make a mess of it, the first bloke's likely to get killed is you. So they were particularly hazardous. A tour on a fighter squadron was 200 hours. The tour on bomber squadron was 35 missions. A tour on six squadron was 60 missions. But I only did, I think, 42 before they cancelled it, because as the AUC said, you've been shot down twice. They nearly got you both times. You've been a good squadron pilot and a good squadron bloke. We don't ask any more than any pilots. You are now touring expired. Shut up! Next time you open your mouth, you can order three beers, one of which will be for me.
When was it that you actually arrived back in Fremantle in Australia?
Oh, late 45. Can't remember when. Late 45.
So obviously the war was over.
Yep.
Let's talk about where you were on VE Day. Do you recall?
No. I think I was on board the ship coming home because we heard this... We had got ourselves in range with Australian Broadcasting. It was quite unusual to hear an Australian accent over the ship's radio. And I think they said then, well, A-bomb's been dropped on Hiroshima.
That was VJ Day,
yep.
Some months later.
Yeah.
What of VE Day, Victory in Europe?
Yeah, I think I was in the transit camp, I think, at Castlereagh.
What was the feeling like then to know that we've got him, it's finished?
Oh, well, I suppose everybody felt... a feeling of comfort, a feeling of success, and you knew that the days of taking off that morning and maybe getting shot up the bum were over, and you now had to return to what was considered normal life, as from immediately.
What did it feel like to know that you were one of the people that had gotten through?
I don't think I ever thought of it. Now, I knew that a lot of my friends had been killed, and I was lucky to survive, but that's all there was to it. There were lots of lucky blokes besides myself. The thought that worried me most then, and I'd not thought too much about this because I didn't know whether I was going to survive the war or not, but now, once I got back to Australia, I knew I'd be demobbed, and my income would finish. And here I was, 24... The only skill I had was flying aeroplanes, and I'm sure Mr. Myers, Mr. Coles and Mr. Woolworth weren't a bit bloody interested in the fact that I could fly an aeroplane. And I began to wonder how I'd go about getting a job. And because I had no skills, of course, because of the education that I didn't have. And that worried me for a while.
What was the atmosphere like when you got home?
Not much. My mother and stepfather picked me up at the Perth Railway Station. Oh dear, and I was carted round to see several relatives before we got home, and our little pup, Nip, immediately recognised me and piddled all over the kitchen with excitement and jumped up and down. And the following morning, my mum's older brother, who was my Uncle Neville, who'd been at Gallipoli and didn't get a scratch, He came across to see me and congratulated me on Durham. And he said to me, next time you... My uncle Neville was number one in the lands department. And he said, next time you're coming into the city, come up to the office and pick me up. And don't forget to bring 2 and 4p. Okay, Uncle Nev. 2 and 4p was a very essential part of the meeting, because we would walk from his office down the terrace to the Palace Hotel. In those days, one of the premier hotels in Perth. Marvellous old place. Very old-fashioned, but marvellous. And they used to sell you beer in the front bar in a glass which was called a schooner. Very attractive-looking glass. And a schooner in the saloon bar was 7p. So if I bought beer for me and Uncle Nev, it was 1 and 2p. If you did it twice, it was 2 and 4p. And we'd have 4 beers each, and then I walked back to the office with him, and there you were. And that, I was home. But Mum insisted on taking me around to all manner of friends, because I was a bit lucky in a way. I got a Distinguished Flying Cross, which was a nice surprise. And of course, Mum carted me everywhere and talked about this bloody DFC for months and months and months.
To what degree was there a sense of let down on return home?
Oh, I don't know that I thought I was let down. I don't think what happened to me was any different than happened to other hundreds and hundreds of people.
No, but the sort of sense of 1 minute you're up here fighting a war and the next minute you're in Perth...
At the Palace Pub.
At the Palace Pub, but there ain't much action, really, when you think about it.
All over. Everything comes to an end eventually. That was all there was. No good worrying about it. And some people I know offered a permanent commission in the Air Force. So if somebody had done something quite outstanding or something like that, a few people were offered a permanent commission, but I wasn't.
How did that feel? Did you want to continue on?
Oh, not particularly. I found the Air Force... When we were with 6th Squadron in Yugoslavia, we were very lucky. We were given a job and we were left alone to get on with it. That was it. There was no ceremonial. It wasn't a case of saluting everything that moved and saying, yes sir, no sir, 3 bags full sir, can I have your permission to do this or can I do this? No. I had full control of the RAAF, or the RAF where we were, and I had the right to do what I wanted and to prioritise all things as I saw them to be or saw them needed to be.
Was it a difficult transition to go from that position into civilian life? Given the responsibility that you'd been given over the, in some cases, the life of other men.
Yeah, not really. I mean, one day I was doing this, the next I was doing that because the situation had changed. And believe me, there was nothing I could do about it.
Was it boring being back in Perth?
Yep. Very boring. I had a lot of fun with 6th Squadron, a hell of a lot of fun with 6th Squadron. And I was going out with one of the most attractive women in all Italy for quite some time. And Patty and I became very, very, very close. Very close. But then, of course, you know what they say, the fickle finger of fate. But I don't think I had any regrets. One thing I did enjoy, the wonderful few years I'd had. And the unbelievable level of good luck that I'd have. I mean, to get shot down twice into an occupied country and get out of it, I don't think I would have got out of it by myself if I hadn't had the support, the marvellous support, of groups of partisan bands. And as soon as I showed them that little red star, I was home and home.
In relation to your return home, what of comrades from your experience? Did you have anyone to...
No. There were very few Western Australians were posted to where I was in 3 Squadron. I was posted to 3 Squadron very early, and about a year later, a bloke that I trained with, a fellow called Doc McLeod, who came from South Perth, he and I were on the same training course, which was training course number 15, and he was posted to 3 Squadron. But unfortunately, Doc was killed shortly thereafter. And I never met any other West Australians overseas at all.
People mention the experience of coming back and not being able to tell their story to other people. Was that something that you experienced?
Yep, I never said anything to anybody.
Why not?
I don't think any of them would be interested, really. That part of my life was over. I mean, you've got to match your feelings and your actions to the circumstances that prevail.
And people talk of keeping their stories to themselves and only sharing them with comrades, because there was a situation that only comrades would understand.
Well, I didn't have any comrades because nobody else was in 3 Squadron other than Doc, who was killed.
And how did that make your experience a difficult one in civilian life?
Very difficult, because Doc and I, rather stupidly one evening, we made an agreement that if one of us was shot down, the other one would take back whatever kit chap who had been killed had, and go and visit the family. Of course, you make these ridiculous arrangements when you're quite convinced it'll never happen. Oh boy, and I can remember walking down a dark street in South Fremantle with Doc's kit bag on my shoulder and thinking, what the bloody hell am I doing here? And, And I went to Doc's home, and they had an extended family there, and they had a minister of the church that was there, and I thought, I don't think Doc followed the religion too much. If any, it would be Church of England, I think. But they'd gone through quite a deal of worry to make things as pleasant as they could for me, although I couldn't get over the feeling that they were all sitting on that side of the table in the kitchen with a roaring fire going and ice cold bottles of beer all over the place. And they were thinking to themselves, what's this bloke sitting here, hale and healthy, drinking our bloody beer and eating our sausages when Doc's dead and buried somewhere in France? They never said a word, and they went out of their way to make me feel comfortable, but I just couldn't help that, and I'd have given anywhere to be somewhere else. But Doc was the only bloke I knew from the 3 Squadron in those days, and nobody from 6 Squadron came from Australia.
What did you talk about in that situation?
Well, they asked me how well I knew Doc, and I said we'd gone on leave together, and he tried to teach me to sail at a little place called Ishmaelia, which is on the Red Sea, and we played a lot of tennis, which we did, we played a lot of billiards, which we did, and we drank a lot of beer. I don't think I told that one. But it was very nice. They had little pies and sausage rolls and red sausages on sticks and sandwiches and cups of tomato soup. But I couldn't help that feeling that they were looking at, saying, why is this bloke hale and hearty? And our son's dead in France.
Did they ask you to sort of explain your experience of war to them?
Nope, never a word, not a word. They just asked me how I got on with Doc and how we got on with blokes from the squad, and he was very popular, Black Doc. He was a little black, Doc McLeod. He was barely 5'3". And we had a CO at the time who was fairly unpopular. Very difficult bloke, our CO. He's dead now, of course. The Doc was a very quiet, placid black. He got the nickname Doc because at that time the wonderful cartoon from Walt Disney of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out, and Doc was the absolute image of Doc in the Seven Dwarfs. And he was a very powerful bloke, Doc. He played lacrosse, he played squash, and he was only short, but he was about that wide, and he was a very strong man. And this CO, in the late at night, with a couple of pilot officers who were busting to become flying officers at any price, they'd come around and tip you out of bed, which was a great joke. We had what were called camp stretchers, and they were fairly fragile, and they didn't stand up to much rough play. They weren't designed for that. As a sergeant, I wasn't entitled to a bedroll. I had to sleep on the ground. And when you got to the squadron, they'd write your name on a list. And when an officer who had a bedroll was killed, the bloke on the top of the list got that bedroll, and so on. And finally, after about 6 months, I got a bedroll. And of course, this bloody stupid CO would sort of turn you out of bed, and they'd all laugh their heads off. And I can remember one night, the moon was very, very low in the sky. It was early, it was late at night, rather. And Doc used to wear a nightshirt. I never got over that. The only nightshirt I'd ever seen was watching Laurel and Hardy films. And we heard the CO and these two blokes laughing their heads off as they went into the next tent to us and up into a few camp stretchers. And Doc said, if that stupid bastard puts his head in there, I'm going to knock his bloody head off. and I can still see Doc in his nightshirt, the silhouette, walking past my bed to get under the fly of the tent. And this CO wasn't all that big, and he was a little skinny bloke. Don't know what he weighed, but he was very skinny. But he had these two POs who were good friends of his and trying to be flying officers. And of course, if you're bent on tipping somebody out of bed, you don't take the precaution of shining a torch under the fly of the tent to see if there's anyone lurking there behind, which is where Doc was standing. And this CO said, "Come on, chaps, wakey, wakey," and Doc went out and went whack. And this bloke, the CO, actually left the bloody ground and fell flat on his back. And the other two said, "Oh, come on, sir, we'll go back and have a drink. These blokes haven't got a sense of humour." And from that day on, you wouldn't believe the unhelpful jobs that everybody in that tent got. Oh. But from that day on, our life became just a little bit difficult because of the things we were given to do and asked to do and told to do. But not long after that, the CO was replaced and everything was all right. But I can still see Doc whacking this bloke. Doc was short, but he had bloody thick arms and heavy legs, and he was a soccer player. Oh. But that caused a little bit of ruction in our tent. Not that anyone minded, everybody disliked our CO intently.